Time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are the sun. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hi, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This month, witness the award of the Nobel Prizes. In this show, we're going to cover winners and what they won for. Actually, before we do that, for those who may not be aware, what are the Nobel Prizes? Well, they had their beginning as a result of a typo from a French newspaper. First, we should inform you that the Nobel Prize was established by Alfred Nobel. Alfred became extremely rich as an armaments manufacturer, but his real fortune stemmed from his invention of dynamite, the miracle compound, from a military standpoint, that allowed for the safe use of the explosive nitroglycerin. So one day, Alfred was reading a French newspaper and was quite surprised to discover that apparently he was dead. That is, he was reading his own obituary in the paper. Of course, the obit was a mistake, but one that had a profound effect on Alfred, because he was quite taken aback that he was described in the obit as the merchant of death. In what one might call a deathbed conversion of sorts, Alfred sought to transform his legacy from merchant of death to a patron of humanity. To that end, he wrote and publicized his will, wherein a series of prizes were to be created for those who conferred, quote, greatest benefit on mankind in physics, chemistry, physiology or medicine, literature, and peace. 94% of his estate was to be endowed to the Nobel Foundation, whose job it would be to hand out the prizes. Side note, some of you may be aware that parts of the prizes are administered by Norway and others by Sweden. This is because when Alfred created the prize, Norway and Sweden were one country. That actually ended in 1905, about a decade after Alfred's death. So, for the winners, in physics, was actually two teams, Takaki Kichita and Canada's own Arthur MacDonald. They won for discovering oscillations in neutrinos, proving neutrinos had mass. First, I guess I should give a quickie about what a neutrino is. There's this thing called the Standard Model. Basically, this is the fundamental model for all matter and energy in the universe. It's not necessary to go into it to great detail, although it is likely to be covered in a future episode of A Sense of Science on Radio Freethinker. But for now, one of the fundamental particles of the universe are neutrinos. Actually, there are three flavors, as physicists like to call them, the electron, muon, and tau. Again, just take that as sort of red. So one of the side effects of stellar fusion is neutrino creation. In fact, the sun is spewing out billions and billions of electron neutrinos every second. There are millions of them passing through every inch of your body every second. Wow, can you feel them? A little prickling in the back of your neck, maybe? Okay, I'm screwing with you. One of the things about neutrinos is they only seem to react with the weak nuclear force. Translation, they don't, or more accurately, very, very, very rarely interact with regular matter. So you're blissfully unaffected and unaware that these little buggers are streaming through you right now. Now, according to the Standard Model, neutrinos are supposed to be massless, all part of the non-interference thing. However, it was noted that the number of electron neutrinos coming from the sun was less than expected. This was called the solar neutrino problem, and it plagued science since the 60s. However, our Nobel Prize winners, working on theoretical work of others, showed that neutrinos can change their flavor. Remember I said that neutrinos came in three flavors? Well, the sun produces only one kind, the electron neutrino. However, these guys used unique observatories to show that not only do we get electron neutrinos from the sun, but also Mao and Tau neutrinos, and that these two other types are a result of the electron neutrino, I want to say decay, but that's not right. You see, subatomic particles are weird. It seems that the neutrinos can oscillate or switch from one flavor to another, then back again. How? Science. Enough for us to know that when looking for all three types of neutrinos, the solar neutrino problem was solved. It turned out, during their trip to Earth, the neutrinos oscillated, So when measured on Earth, a third were electrons, a third were muons, and a third were tau, more or less. As a bonus of sorts, and why science is not dogmatic but evolving knowledge, it disproved the standard model. You see, in order to do this, flavor changing, the neutrinos had to have mass. Again, why? Science. Just trust me on this one. It needs to have mass. This meant that the standard model was wrong. So what did the science community do? Did they suppress this knowledge? Did they banish those unfortunate scientists? No, they went back to the whiteboard, changed the model to accommodate neutrinos with mass. And those scientists have just been rewarded for overturning the theoretical apple cart and forcing the model to comply with reality. Science for the win! Another bonus fact. Remember I said they used unique observatories? That neutrinos rarely interact with regular matter. They only rarely react because the only part of the world they see are the nucleuses of atoms. That part where you find the protons and the neutrons. And if you remember from past shows on Radio Free Thinker, or just doing a quick Google search, if an atom were the size of BC Place, well, the nucleus would be about the size of a marble at the center. The electrons would be about the size of a bacteria whizzing around the seats. Anyway, the point being that most of the volume of an atom is empty space. So to a neutrino, most of the universe is empty space. That said, every so often, an unlucky neutrino will find that nucleus and bam, a nuclear explosion of sorts. So the observatory these scientists created to observe neutrinos were essentially giant vats of dry cleaning fluid. Why? When chlorine in these fluids gets hit by a neutrino, it transforms from chlorine to argon and a photon is released. To capture this photon, these vast vats of fluids are surrounded by an immense number of very sensitive cameras. They record these flashes, and this is how neutrinos are observed. Did I also mention that these observatories need to be deep underground? You see, it's not only neutrinos that can cause flashes, but other things. So the deeper the vat, the less likely other things can make their way into their observatory. The depth scientists will go to overturn the fundamental understanding of the universe. Sheesh. So that was physics. The word for chemistry is really kind of a cross or more akin to biology. And there were three people who won, each discovering three parts of a single job. What job? The repairing of our DNA. Now, as many of you know, DNA is the foundation or blueprint of life as we know it. One would think that DNA must be pretty robust to have survived billions of years and evolved into, well, every living thing we see. I guess everything extinct as well. As it turns out, DNA is as sturdy as tissue paper. That said, life finds a way. So as easy as it is for DNA to be corrupted, we have evolved a number of repair mechanisms to ensure our continued existence. How can DNA go bad? Well, first we need to have an understanding that DNA is written in base pairs. That is, base G is always paired with base C, base A is always paired with base T. It's a fundamental alphabet of life. Now, G is really guanine, C is actually codeine, A is actually adenine, and T is actually thymine. That said, when a section of DNA is being copied, be it to create a new cell or the like, sometimes a mistake is made. On the original, you may have A, which should be paired with the C, but sometimes a T is written by mistake. One winner, a Thomas Little, showed that DNA spontaneously decays at such a rapid rate that development of life on Earth should have been impossible. This led him to look at how this collapse of DNA is prevented, and he discovered one such mechanism, base excision repair. When part of the DNA strand mutates or spontaneously changes, a specific enzyme discovers the defect and cuts the damage out of the strand. Further enzymes then join in the action, filling in the gaps with the original or correct sequence. Another winner, Paul Murdoch, showed that when DNA is being copied, like during cell division, this replication process is not error-free. Sometimes a mistake is made. So the original had guanine, which should be paired with cytosine. But thymine was written instead. another mutation has occurred. Well, in a process called mismatch repair, I know, not a very creative, but at least accurate name. Well, anyway, this is basically a genetic spell checker that checks the original half of the DNA and checks the new part. If it doesn't match, it is cut and replaced with an appropriate base. The last winner focused not on internal errors in DNA replication, but damage done to DNA by external sources, such as ultraviolet light. This kind of damage not only affects a single base pair, but stretches of DNA. Aziz Zankar mapped the mechanism that exists to repair this damage, called nucleotide excision repair. When a stretch of DNA is corrupted by ultraviolet radiation, the enzymes involved in this mechanism come along and remove a large piece of DNA containing the fault. The resulting gap is then filled in. The award for medicine went to two groups of researchers who basically found, quote, natural compounds, extracted the bioactive compound of worth, refined and enhanced its ability to kill parasites. In the case of William C. Campbell and Satoshi Omura, the target parasites were hemlins, parasitic worms that plague around one-third of the world's population. These worms are responsible for lymphatic filariasis, often called elephantitis, and river blindness. They created avermercetin by laboriously screening strains of streptomycin bacteria, a group known for their antimicrobial agents. Avermercetin was later chemically modified to improve its effectiveness, resulting in a novel class of drugs that are remarkably effective against these devastating diseases. The other winner, Toyuyu, took inspiration from traditional Chinese herbal medicine, where a plant called Artemisinin Ananu had received a lot of attention as a promising candidate against malaria parasite Plasmodium falciparum. Extracts from the plant failed to produce consistent antimicrobial effects, but Yo-Yo eventually managed to isolate and purify the bioactive compound from the plant, demonstrating its effectiveness in both humans and animals. Eventually named Artemisinin, or my best pronunciation of that word, that's led to a whole group of extremely potential medications that are regarded as a cornerstone in the treatment of malaria. Side note on that last one. Some might be saying, see, herbal medicine works. Well, no, remember the extract failed to work consistently. But something in there was of worth. And when stripped of all the other crap that you would get with sort of herbal concoctions, well, then real medicine emerges and a new drug was created. There are also awards for peace and literature, but who cares? Okay, some of you likely do. The winner for literature was Svetlana Alexievich for, and I quote, her polyphonic writing, a monument to suffering and courage in our time. Okay, I confess, for the sake of some diversity on the show, for a taste of something different, I thought I would attempt to cover the Nobel Prize in Literature, but I can't get it. I mean, don't get me wrong, Svetlana's work seems interesting, and as Wiki describes it, she's the first journalist to win the prize, but no, not something my skills could do justice to. If you, any of the attentive listeners to Radio Freethinker, wish to tackle this job, maybe become Radio Freethinker's cultural reporter, draw me a line at info@radiofreethinker.com. Now, I'm a bit better place to talk about the Peace Prize, this year won by the Tunisian National Dialogue Quartet, again to quote, for its decisive contribution to building a pluralistic democracy in Tunisia in the wake of the Jasmine Revolution in 2011, the only real win from the Arab Spring. Lastly, Alfred Nobel made no provision for a Nobel Prize in Economics. This category was a creation of the Swedish National Bank, an attempt to make it seem that economics was a science, which it definitely is not. But an attempt to create a sense of authority, the Swedish Bank created the prize to, quote, in the memory of Alfred Nobel, in 1968. Not only is it a faker, but it's trying to leech onto the Alfred Nobel's legacy. Disgusting, in my opinion. I could mention the winner, but as economics is a form of fiction, and I've already stressed my limits by alluding to the award for literature, well, enough said. As we all know, economics, the art of explaining tomorrow why the predictions of yesterday didn't come true today. We'll be right back after this break.
Another night's work well done. And so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro, and I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pit my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Hello, this week on Radio Free Thinkers Cryptid Corner, we're covering another classic cryptid, the Loch Ness Monster, or Nessie to her friends. And yes, we know she is a she because, let me get back to you on that one. Nessie itself is a classic lake monster with many relatives found around the world. She is described as a long-necked aquatic reptile with a central body and flipper-like appendages. Now, because we are discussing a cryptid, let us not get too rigid with that description. Many mentioned something more akin to a large snake-like object. Others describe something more crocodilian in nature. The earliest record of Nessie dates back to the 7th century AD, when a Scottish monk wrote a book about St. Columbus, who a century before had stumbled upon the burial site of a man who had been attacked and killed by a water beast in the vicinity of Loch Ness. The trouble here is, even the learned monk in the Dark Ages believed in monsters and demons, and that's not uncommon for the lives of the saints to be sprinkled with little supernatural encounters, which presumably made them more engaging for the reader than saying just something like he had a long slog through the peat bog. Then there's the fact that the monk did not witness Nessie himself, but is recounting a story, which leads to another problem. The story was a century old. If that's not sufficient to sow seeds of doubt, we could always label it as anecdotal. Nessie remained an obscure local legend until about 80 years ago, when in 1933 a man named George Spencer claimed to see a huge, long-necked, most extraordinary form of animal slowly crossing the road in front of his car, seemingly on its way back to Loch Ness. That in itself may have been written off as, how shall we say, Spicer and the Mrs. partook of a little lake nectar, which has been known to fog one's sight and memory. I say might have, because this sighting was followed up by another account a month later by a motorcyclist named Arthur Grant, who claimed that he narrowly avoided striking the beastie well out on a midnight drive. The number of sightings became regular fare after 1933. Why? Well, it was 1933 that a road was built to what was previously a relatively isolated part of the world. There have been over 1,000 recorded sightings of the monster, or around 20 a year. You may have also noted that these sightings were not on the loch itself, but crossing the newly built road. Nessie sightings sporadically occurred on land until 1960. So why did she stop crossing the road? I'm sure there's a joke in there somewhere. Of course, what made Nessie world famous was not these anecdotal accounts. No, it was the photographic proof that made Nessie real. The most famous photo, the iconic one, was captured by Robert Kenneth Wilson in 1934. Referred to as the surgeon's photo, it purports to show the head and neck of Nessie. He claimed that he was looking out at the loch when he saw the monster, so he grabbed his camera and snapped four photos. Only two exposures came out somewhat clear. The first one shows what was claimed to be a small head and back, while the second one shows a similar head in a diving position. The first one became iconic, while the second one attracted little publicity because it was difficult to interpret what was being depicted, its quality being less than the first. Side note, it's called the surgeon's photograph because Wilson was a gynecologist or doctor, surgeon was a synonym for doctor back then. As he didn't want his name associated with a pic, it became known as the surgeon's photo, thus preserving Wilson's anonymity to this day. Yes, read that as ironic. Although skeptics tried to show that the image could be anything from a piece of driftwood to an elephant, yes, elephant, the story goes that there was a traveling circus in the neighborhood, and they, it is claimed, let the elephant go for a swim. What the photo shows is the elephant's trunk extended and nostrils flared. Well, at least we know elephants exist, which makes it one up on the other explanations. This photo was seen, as I said, as proof. That is until 1970, when a few anomalies were pointed out and the image was declared a fake. Some of the things that did not add up was the size of the water ripples. The photo is often depicted as being taken far away and the ripples caused by large waves. However, when the image is seen uncropped, the ripples are more applicable to those seen in a photograph taken close to Nessie. But if it was close to Nessie and were small ripples, did that mean that the Loch Ness Monster was more a mouse than an elephant? No, it eventually came out that the photograph was indeed a hoax, that the photo was a toy submarine with fake dino head glued onto it. What was the proof of that? Well, it turned out the photograph was revenge on the Daily Mail. The Nessie bot was built by Christian Sperling, the son-in-law of Marmaduke Wetherell. Wetherell was a big game hunter who had been publicly ridiculed by his employers in the Daily Mail. After finding, quote, Nessie footprints that turned out to be those of a hippopotamus foot umbrella stand. To get revenge on the Mail, Withering committed a hoax with co-conspirators. Sperling, who is a sculpture specialist, his son Ian, who bought the materials for the fake, and Maurice Chambers, a friend of the family. The toy submarine was bought from F.W. Woolworth, a kind of Walmart of its day. Its head and neck were made out of plastic wood. The group went to Loch Ness, where Ian Wetherall took the photo in the vicinity of the Altside Tea House. Chambers handed the plates over to Wilson, a friend of his who enjoyed a good practical joke. Wilson then took the plates to Orstings, an Inverness chemist, where he gave them to George Morrison for development. He sold the first photo to the Daily Mail, who then announced that the Loch Ness Monster had been photographed. This may also explain why Wilson did not want his name associated with the photo. Side note, while creating the photo, a water bailiff, a law enforcement officer responsible for policing the bodies of water, approached in an attempt to conceal what they were doing. Duke Wetherall put his foot out and sank the model. It is presumably still there somewhere in Loch Ness. So for those adventurous types, you may not be able to find the real Loch Ness Monster, but a dollar to the person who can bring me the original model. Okay, but there are other photos. Hell, there are a number of videos of Nessie. They can't all be fakes, no? Well, we could check out the various groups, societies, and expeditions that have attempted to answer the question, is Nessie real? There have been many attempts to find Nessie, and not all by the ghost hunter types, but genuine, credible investigators. As early as 1934, the Sir Edmund Mountain Expedition tried to find the truth. Sir Mountain financed the placement of 20 men, each with binoculars and cameras around Loch Ness from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. for 5 weeks starting the 13th of July 1934. They took 21 photographs, though none were considered conclusive. There were some more positive developments. In the late 1960s, the Loch Ness Paranormal Investigation Bureau, or LNPIB, sonar study was ostensibly a test for a new sonar detection system. Basically, it placed a sonar net across the middle of the loch, to the effect that no moving object could pass undetected. During the two-week trial in August, multiple targets 20 feet in length were identified, ascending from and diving to the loch's bottom. Analysis of the diving profile ruled out air breathers because the targets were never surfaced or moved shallower than mid-water. So, if Nessie was not an air breather, that would rule out most of the possible explanations for the Loch Ness Monster. Then again, it does provide some support, although that doesn't exclude driftwood. I'm just saying. Side note, based on the sonar evidence, as unclear as it was, British naturalist Peter Scott announced in 1975 on the basis of these photographs that the scientific name of the monster would henceforth be Nessetera rhomboterix, which is Greek for the Ness Monster with diamond-shaped fins. Scott explained that this would enable Nessie to be added to the British Registry of Officially Protected Wildlife. That said, one Scottish politician, Nicholas Fairbairn pointed out that the name was an anagram for Monster Hoax by Sir Peter S. Coincidence or Scottish humor? I'll let you decide. Of course, it was only a matter of time before a conclusive search was done. Unlike our previous cryptid, Bigfoot, having a possible range of thousands of miles, well, Nessie dwells in a relatively small lake. Okay, it is the second largest in area in Scotland, and thanks to its depths, actually has more water than all of the other lakes in England and Wales combined. That said, still only 56 square miles, and although an average depth of 433 feet is impressive, nothing a systemic sonar scan couldn't handle. So, in 2003, the BBC performed the most extensive and conclusive scan of the loch. It involved 600 separate sonar beams and satellite tracking. The search had enough resolution to pick up a small buoy. And that small buoy as in B-U-O-Y, not B-O-Y. Although size-wise, they're probably about the same. Before we give you the results, let's ask an important question. If only for our own entertainment. If Nessie were real, what is a Nessie? As mentioned, Nessie could be a misplaced class of cryptid, i.e. the elephant taking a bath. This would include various explanations involving eels, sharks, and seals. Some have claimed that it's a rare long-necked newt, rare as in the only version of this newt that is 20 feet long. Others think it's a giant bristleworm, and by giant, I mean most bristleworms are measured in millimeters, not feet. Of course, there are two other classes that could be involved. The premature extinct fossil cryptid, or an evolved cryptid. One of those being that Nessie is really a theropod. Yes, a relative of Brontosaurus. The only problem with this explanation is that theropods are land animals. Even if we assume, as some paleontologists believe, that some theropods may have spent most of their lives in water eating seaweed or the like, they are still land animals. It seems unlikely a 20-foot dinosaur would not have been seen or captured by someone's cell phone while wandering around Eucor Castle on the banks of Loch Ness. The other, if only slightly more plausible candidate for Nessie, is a plesiosaurus. Now, like the theropods, plesiosaurus were not oxygen breathers as in fish, but air breathers, meaning they would have spent a lot of time near the surface. Think whale. So sightings would have been as common as whale watching. Another problem is, well, time. Nessie is about 10,000 years old. And why 10,000 years? Well, that's about how much time it's been since the loch itself has been pinched off from the Atlantic Ocean. And you might explain that a theropod was just wandering around and made Inverness home. But the plesiosaurs were extinct 65 million years ago, plus or minus, previous to the Loch Ness's existence. So even if one somehow made it to Loch Ness, well, there's just not enough food to feed what would likely have been a 10-ton plesiosaur. So let us return to the results of the BBC expedition. Based on the extensive and exhaustive examination of every part of the loch, there's only one conclusion. No animal of any substantial size was found whatsoever, and despite high hopes, the scientists involved in the expedition admit that this essentially proves the Loch Ness Monster was a myth. So that was over a decade ago. And to be fair, since the 70s, or at least the 90s, it was pretty clear that Nessie was a phantom and not real. And yet to this day, people still have honest convictions and complete confidence that Nessie is real. Why does this belief system persist? In my humble opinion, there are three categories of these people. There are those who, frankly, are making a buck off Nessie. Some of those are, quote, honest, ambivalent shills, those people who sell souvenirs and make money off the tourist trade. These types are often a tad tongue-in-cheek about the existence of Nessie. They are the same people who present magic tours, etc. At one level, we all know it's fake, but it's fun to believe in the impossible, be it magic or a sea monster. The others are perhaps people like me. When I was 13, naive, so no, you don't have to be a child to be enticed by the possibility that dinosaurs or even Mesozoic reptiles still roam the Earth, as the X-Files so often tapped into, we want to believe, even if the evidence is against it. Then there are the charlatans. These are not like the local offshoots from the tourist angle, cheerfully jiggering the local economy with that little bit of credulity. As I said, most of those are more tongue-in-cheek, but this other type are making fraudulent claims, as these people know, must know on some level, that what they are saying is false and exploitative. And yet, there's a book to hawk, a TV program to promote, Yes, I'm looking at you, supposed learning channel, and you bastard child of Discovery Channel. Anyway, I think that's all we have to say about Nessie this week. We'll be right back after this break.
That ship out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try anyway. Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter. You can't tell me the captain couldn't have brought his ship in without the help of that publicity-seeking show-off, Spider-Man!
Don't get caught wasting power. Unplug cell phone, camera, and other battery chargers when charging is complete. Many electronic devices continue to use power even when you are not operating them. The amount of energy consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
And we're back. And now it's time for A Sense of Science, a regular segment when we explore and explain some of the basics of science that we all think we know, but do we? This week is a discussion about radiation, a word often used to instill fear in people regarding the supposed dangers of Wi-Fi, or not to mention the dreaded iPhone. So what is radiation? Well, there are three ways this term could be used: thermal transfer, electromagnetic waves, and nuclear decay. Let's start with perhaps the most common use of the term, radiation as a method of transferring or dissipating heat. A radiator is called such because, well, it radiates heat. But there are other ways for heat to move from one locale to another. Heat transfer, or dissipation, is one of the great tools humanity has mastered and allowed us to expand around the world. Heat transfer, or dissipation, is one of the great tools humanity has mastered and allows us to expand around the world. The creation of fire allowed for and resulted in heat that provided warmth, cooked our food, and the application of heat that made metals, or the innovations as fundamental as air conditioning and refrigeration, were all made possible with our mastery of heat transfer. I'll wager most of you have little notion of how it actually works. Turns out there are four basic ways to transfer heat: advection, conduction, convection, and radiation, all of them visible in a simple cup of coffee. Let's start with advection. That is the physical movement of one fluid over another. When the two intersect, heat is transferred, or like blowing on a hot cup of coffee to cool it down. The air, one fluid, at least in a physics context, is passing over another, the coffee. When it does, some of the heat is transferred from the coffee to the air. Often moisture is produced in the form of steam. Well, technically not steam, but condensate, sort of microclouds. So what is the difference between steam and condensate? Well, in common parlance, they are the same. But when water turns into gas, the common used term is steam. Although, in technical jargon, it is water vapor. We see this when water is poured into a kettle and the water boils. At a sufficient energy state, meaning it is hot enough, essentially the water molecules become airborne and steam is born. Now, although steam can also be called water vapor, not all water vapor need be hot. It need only to have sufficient energy to float in the air, if you will. Think evaporation, but don't limit yourself to that. So steam is a subset of water vapor, specifically water molecules above the boiling point. So all steam is water vapor, but technically not all vapor is steam. Of course, when it's cold out, we've all seen the steam produced when we exhale, but that's not even really warm, let alone boiling. Well, true, but this is not steam in the technical sense, but is instead condensate, which is in fact what most of us commonly mean when we use the word steam. Basically, condensate is the opposite of what happens when water vaporizes. It loses sufficient energy and therefore flight. More accurately, to keep away from other particles, water or dust, these weak water molecules congregate and form drops, usually micro drops, and that's the little white stuff we see and we think of as steam, when really they're miniature clouds. Kind of cool when you think about it. When you exhale into the cold, you're actually a cloud machine. So, getting back, when you blow on your coffee, you cool it because one fluid is rubbing up against another and energy or heat is transferred from one to the other. And that heat transfer is called advection. Another way to transfer heat is via conduction. This is when two surfaces touch. The coffee touches the coffee cup. The energetic molecules of the coffee are essentially smacking up against the walls of the cup. Each collision transfers some energy, heat, from the coffee into the cup. Thus, when you wrap your hands around the cup, it feels warm, maybe even hot. This is conduction. This is also why a hot mug will keep coffee hot longer. Not that the mug heats the coffee. After all, it was steaming hot to begin with. But when the coffee molecules slam up against the cup molecules, they have similar energy. So less or no heat is transferred. Thus, the coffee keeps its heat, ergo stays hot longer. Of course, when you lose heat, be it advection on the surface or conduction on the edges, most of the coffee in the center of the cup is still hot. If it's too hot to drink, we will use a spoon to stir the cup. This allows for heat transfer via convection. That is, by the mixing of different levels of the liquid, heat is dissipated as the hot coffee mixes with the cooler coffee. The hot molecules in the center migrate to the edge, where advection and convection can do their thing. As well, you get cool molecules moving into the hot center, being hit by the hot molecules, heating them back up. But thanks to the second law of thermodynamics, the heat lost by the hot coffee is more than that gained by the cool coffee, and thus the cup as a whole becomes cooler. Of course, convection is also seen when we boil water. The water closest to the burner becomes hot and rises. This creates a vacuum of sorts, where you have the cooler water sink or suck down to fill the vacuum and in turn gets heated by the burner. This continues until all the water is turned into vapor. Now, I remember on a cold winter day having a cup of hot coffee and holding it in both my hands in an effort to keep them warm, and they were. The last kind of heat transfer found is in your beloved cup of Joe is radiant heat. That is heat energy that, radiates out. That sounds a little simplistic, so let's give it another go. We mentioned before on a previous episode of Radio Freethinker that energy can be seen as different wavelengths. Think color plus. Some we see as blue or green, but there are large parts of the spectrum not visible to us. One part of that spectrum is infrared. This is where heat can be seen, or not. So in a very real way, your hot cup of coffee is like a light bulb, but the light it radiates is beyond the perception of the human eye, but not our hands. Ergo, it feels like it's giving off a warm glow, which it is. You can't see the heat, but we can feel it. Now, that was a bit of a quick and dirty on the subject. I hope as well, if there are any questions, corrections, or requests for clarification, listeners for Radio Freethinker will let me know by emailing me at info@radiofreethinker.com. Okay. Do some of you feel a tad disappointed? I promised a banquet and so far all you got is hot coffee. The Hulk wasn't created by a blast of hot coffee. And yes, radiation as we know it is energetic particles. So let's explore them. Now, as already mentioned, heat is in the form of light. Of course, more accurately, heat and light are manifestations of the electromagnetic spectrum, which is really photons moving between things. Now, radiation and radioactivity are two different things. Radiation is, as stated, the giving off of energy, usually via photons. Or put another way, radiation is the radiating of energy. Should I add a like duh to that? Photonic radiation, at least the type we are most acquainted with, is electromagnetic energy. This is light, radio waves, and much more. And although we have different names for them, the fact is they are all the same thing, photons with different wavelengths. So whether it be a flashlight or a cell phone, both are emitting photons. Now some of you may be saying, wavelengths from x-rays are very different from those of a glow stick. To that I say yes and no. Wavelength is a measure of photonic energy. Photonic energy. How often do I get to use that in a conversation? So anyway, when you have light, a blue glow stick, for example, the wavelength of the blue light is about 450 nanometers. Conversely, the wavelength of X-rays is anywhere from a nano to a picometer. The power is directly proportional to the wavelength. I'm going to use water as an analogy as a way to think about this. You may remember from high school chemistry class that water, well, I guess everything really, is made up of molecules, and that as the water is heated, those molecules become agitated and move around faster and faster. This is like the increase in wavelength. So the wavelength of radio waves is like ice, slow and not very energetic. As you increase the energy in water or increase your wavelength, ice becomes water. Radio waves become light. If we continue this mental experiment, water becomes steam and light waves become X-rays. All of this is the same thing. Water molecules are photons. It is the manifestation of molecules / photons, ice, liquid, steam, or radio, infrared, or X-rays, that are dependent on the energy of the molecule or the wavelength of the photon. Actually, I've misled you a bit. The power of electromagnetic energy is actually a function of wavelength and frequency. Wavelength being the distance between the peaks of the wave, and frequency is the number of waves per second. They're inversely proportional. That is, the higher the frequency, the smaller the wavelength, and vice versa. A side note, the smaller the wavelength, the finer the resolution, or the smaller the thing it can see using that kind of light, if I may stretch the meaning of the word light. It is this principle that is behind the X-ray, or more common, electron microscope. You see, the smallest wavelength of visible light is about 400 nanometers. If we want to see something smaller, we cannot. But if you raise the frequency and thus shorten the wavelength, it will bounce off smaller objects, so you can actually see them. And let's put "see" in quotes here, because as I said, it's not light as we know it, only a representation of what we would see if we could see things in the X-ray spectrum. Thus, an electron microscope can see things as small as 50 picometers, or about the size of a hydrogen atom. Okay, so I've said that wavelength and frequency are related directly to photonic energy. But you may have noticed that I have yet to use the term energy. So here's the clarification. First, the unit of measure of energy of a photon is an electron volt. By definition, one electron volt is the amount of energy gained or lost by the charge of a single electron moved across an electric potential difference of 1 volt. Oh, okay, that's clear. Sorry, what did I just say? Okay, I checked my handy energy converter, and I'm able to convert electron volts to joules. A joule is equal to the energy transfer or work done to an object when a force of 1 newton acts on that object in the direction of its motion through a distance of 1 meter. Okay, still not much clearer, but there are some real-world examples. So 1 joule is the energy used to lift an apple 1 meter. The heat required to raise the temperature of a gram of water 1/4 degree, or the electricity to power a 1-watt LED light for 1 second. Okay, that might make things a little bit more clearer. So how many joules is 1 electron volt? Well, it's about 160 zeptojoules. Wasn't that one of the Marx Brothers? Anyone? Anyone? We are our history. Anyway, it's actually about 1.6 times 10 to the negative 19th of a joule. As far as raw power, it seems pretty weak tea. But how much power do the photons have at various wavelengths? How much power is my cell phone signal? Radio waves, like those experienced while listening to Radio Free Thinker, wavelengths of about 3 meters and a frequency of about 101.9 megahertz, having an energy of about 4 nanoelectron volts. A blue glow stick has about 2 electron volts. Ultraviolet radiation, the kind that give you a tan in the summer, has about 124 electron volts. X-rays, about 10 kiloelectron volts. Cosmic or gamma rays, always a comic book fan favorite, have a frequency of about 3 billion megahertz. a wavelength of about 1 picometer, and carry about a mega electron volt. Now that is the energy of a single photon. To be fair, even the gamma ray was small. But before we go, we need to cover another important aspect of radiation, and that is the difference between ionizing and non-ionizing radiation. I've thrown around a lot of numbers, but an important one is the amount of energy a photon must have in order to damage or ionize an atom. Or put another way, how many electron volts do you need to strip an electron from an atom? That is, as may seem obvious, its ionizing energy. For example, the ionizing energy of hydrogen is about 14 electron volts. That is, a photon must have at least that much energy to affect hydrogen. It's about the same for oxygen, carbon is about 11. The lowest I can find of the natural elements is about 5 electron volts. That means anything with a wavelength shorter than 100 nanometers, called ultraviolet C, lacks the energy needed to damage an atom, change its chemistry. Why is that important? Well, a number of listeners will have likely heard about the propaganda about the dangers of cell phones and Wi-Fi and the like. Well, now that we have an understanding of electromagnetic radiation, we can actually address the question that often comes up in this context. Is it possible for cell phones or Wi-Fi signals to cause me harm? Cell phones work at a frequency between 800 megahertz to 2.5 gigahertz. That gives them an energy of about 8 microelectron volts. A Wi-Fi router has an energy level of about 20 microelectron volts. If you do the math, that's about 1/10,000 the energy power needed to damage your DNA. So there's no way cell phones, Wi-Fi, or anything of that ilk could give you cancer, any more than a rock can puncture the side of an armored tank. In fact, the light bulb above you is emitting 1,000 times more power than any wireless device, and even it is too weak to be ionizing, DNA damaging. In fact, if you were truly worried about electromagnetic radiation and cancer, you should never go outside, ever. The stuff coming out of the sun contains ultraviolet light, which is up to 124 electron volts, well above the energy needed to ionize hydrogen at all. That is why skin tans. It is the body's attempt to protect itself from the type of radiation that does damage DNA, and sunburns, which is more of an allergic reaction to the damage done to your DNA. You see, blood flow increases the capillary bed of the dermis, the second most outer layer of the skin, so cells can repair the damage, resulting in warmth and redness of the skin. Inflammatory immune cells also flock to the damaged tissue, which it tries to destroy before related damage, such as cancer, can occur. This is what causes our perception of pain. Eventually, the damaged skin cells die, and the burned skin starts to peel off. Okay, there is something missing. As I said, we've talked about the amount of energy each photon has, but we have not talked about the volume of photons and the energy it might have, or its wattage. So here's a question. If microwave radiation is such low power, vis-a-vis electron volt, how do the microwave ovens work? How does it pop my popcorn? Well, as I said, non-ionizing radiation cannot damage your DNA, etc. But it does carry energy. That energy is transferred via induction. Remember the coffee and how heat moves the molecules around. One way was conduction. That is, one energetic atom hits a less energetic atom. Some of that energy is transferred from one to the other, and thus things can heat up. Well, in the case of a microwave oven, energetic photons are hitting the atoms of food. Some of this kinetic energy is transferred to the food and induces a thermatic response, i.e. it becomes hot. Really, in the same way that when you rub your hands together, they get hot. Basically, the same thing in miniature is happening as the photons rub up against the food molecules, causing them to heat up. This, though, leads to another question. It may be that cell phones or Wi-Fi routers are not damaging my DNA, but the idea that my iPhone might be cooking my brain is not in any way more reassuring. It is true, if you have a cell phone or a router of sufficient wattage, it could, quote, cook your brain. But that takes us to the next question. What is sufficient wattage required to do that? Anyone who bought a cheap microwave oven knows that low wattage often takes forever to cook anything. Most microwave ovens on the market for domestic use have a power rating of about 1,000 watts. There is a measure used to help determine how much is too much. It's called the watts per kilogram measure, or the specific absorption rate, which obviously measures the amount of watts a body absorbs per kilo. For reference, my handy cookbook recommends cooking a roast for about 8 minutes at 1,000 watts. That actually works out to be about 1,334 watt-hours, or about 4.8 megajoules. I'll use that as a baseline for our comparison. The level at which most regulators or scientific research have shown to be the maximum safe dosage is approximately 4 watts per kilogram. An MRI provides about 2 to 3 watts, with levels reaching anywhere from 10 to 20 for limited and localized exposures. A cell phone has a maximum wattage of 1.6, and a router of about 100 milliwatts, or about 0.1 watts. How can we convert that to the roast beef number? Well, cell phone rates at 1.6 watt hours, and a Wi-Fi rounds out to a paltry 0.1 watt hour. Those convert to about 5.7 kilojoules and 360 joules respectively. Now when you compare that to the 4.8 megajoules, or roughly 5 million joules, it seems that cell phones and Wi-Fis are harmless. But since most of us use cell phones longer than 8 minutes, is there a risk with prolonged exposure? Okay, let's say you're a chronic user and you talk on your phone for about 4 hours. So using 4 hours as its maximum, that's a joule rating of about 23 kilojoules. Now if that's used every day, well, let's assume there's a cumulative effect. That is an exposure of about 0.6 megajoules over a month, or 8.4 megajoules over a year. Crikey, compared to our roast, we should be calling our brain well done and pouring gravy over it. But, you see, we've committed a logical and scientific error. This kind of energy is not accumulative, like nuclear radiation might be. And this is why it is important to understand the difference between the different meanings and implications of the term radiation. To spell out this fallacy, imagine every day rubbing your hands together. According to the logic we just used, if you start on a New Year's Day, by Valentine's, your hand should have burst into flames. And that, of course, is ridiculous. So no, it is not cooking your brain, or even your ears. Cannot, will not, could not, full stop. That said, a cell phone tower could have as much power as 500 watts. And if that was directed directly at you, well, that would be entering into the oven territory. However, it's not localized wattage, like the microwave oven, nor is it unmitigated, i.e. wood or concrete dramatically reduces the power of the signal. Also, given the fact that you are unlikely to be right next to the tower, and the doubling of the distance from a radio source, technically known as the inverse distance law, well, relative power is about 1/4. So if your microwave or cell tower had a power rating of 1,000 watts at 1 meter, at 2 feet, you'd only have 250 watts. At 4 feet, 62 watts. You get the idea. So don't worry. Okay, still feeling a little let down? I said we're going to talk about radiation, and so far all I've talked about is light, radio waves, and cell phones. You were expecting to find out about the type of radiation that you'd find in nuclear bombs, MRIs, and more titillating power plant explosions like Chernobyl and Fukushima. Well, technically, a lot of that was covered. Most of the fear of radiation we hear about with nuclear energy is gamma ray radiation, which, as mentioned, is a form of photonic energy with a high frequency, small wavelength, and lots of electron volt energy, but very short, very small area of effect. Now, there are other forms of nuclear radiation. Actually, there are 4 types: alpha particles, beta particles, gamma rays, and something called conversion electrons. Yes, that last one was a new one even to me. But as any showman says, always leave them wanting. So listen to next week's Sense of Science on Radio Freethinker, where I'll cover nuclear radiation. That's all the time I think we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com. and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We are at a time in history where we can change the world. What do we want to pass on to future generations? That we just stayed here on Earth, that we didn't look out to find out where we come from and are we alone? No. We want to pass on this joy, this excitement.
When a nation dreams big, everything falls into place.
Beyond the horizon. That's where we make discoveries. That's the next frontier. It is in us to work farther and deeper. It's deep within us. That is why we are all here. Over the next hill, beyond the horizon.
Dream of tomorrow. Long for the open seas. All for this adventure. Dream big, dream big. Dream of tomorrow. For the open seas.
There are lots of huge frozen worlds caught beyond Neptune. Huge frozen worlds. Seek out these other worlds. Hundreds of other worlds caught beyond Neptune. Caught beyond Neptune. Seek out these other worlds.
Audacious visions have the power to alter mind states. To change assumptions about what is possible.
Beyond the horizon, over the next hill, that's where we make discoveries.
That's the next frontier.
It is in us to work farther and deeper. It's deep within us. That is why we are all here. Over the next hill, beyond the horizon.
If we are to discover life on another world, it will change the way everyone feels about what it is to be a living thing in the cosmos.
Is a virus alive? Is crystal alive? Does life need this? Does life need liquid water? Is a virus alive? Does life have metabolism? Does life need...
Life need.
This is a virus alive? Is crystal alive? They're asking these questions.
Working together, I claim we can change the world!
There's a just tremendously exciting prospect called solar sailing.
And it works exactly as an ordinary sailboat does.
It takes you to where you want to go. It's a whole new kind of idea. It travels on the wind from the sun. It takes you to where you want to go. It's a whole new kind of idea. It travels on the wind from the sun.
Dreams prevail in the citizens' ambitions.
It is time to set sail for the 21st century.
Beyond the horizon, over the next hill, that's where we make discoveries.
That's the next frontier.
It is in us to look farther and deeper. It's deep within us. That is why we are all here. Over the next hill, beyond the horizon.
That's the next frontier.
It is in us to look farther and deeper. It's deep within us. That is why we are all here. Over the next hill, beyond the horizon.
Find your place in space. Space is vast and unexplored. There's a lot of work to do.